Hello and welcome back, everybody, to the Ortho Talk Podcast, episode number 39. This week we have recurring guest, Dr. Michael Iluanya. Mike is from episode number 4, Fame. He is a second-year resident at Tulane in New Orleans, and we catch up a little bit, talk about that, and then we get into a really open and honest discussion about residency and how it prepares you for jobs, and probably the most honest discussion you'll hear about picking a job and what kind of job best suits you that on this planet. So give it a listen. Hope you guys enjoy it. Without further ado, Dr. Michael Iluanya.
Hey, can we time out? All right. All good dudes, stop what you're doing. This is Time Out. This is the Ortho Talk Podcast. Today we are doing a real conversation with an illustrious guest. Surgeons today are Asif Khalid and Jay Chen. Antibiotics, ANSEF, of course. What do we even ask? Fire risk, high due to lit conversations and explosive topics. Any questions or concerns? Nope. All right, we can go. Incision.
Welcome back, everybody. Episode number 39. We got Mikey Iluanya, not Iluanye, right, Jay?
From, I told you it wasn't. It's all good.
From episode, what was it, episode 2, 3? Three, yeah. No, 4, episode 4. So what, that's 35 weeks plus a couple weeks that we didn't do it. So like 40 weeks. So it's been like almost a year. Pretty close, bro. How you been?
I've been good. I think last time we did it, I was an intern. And now I'm a second year. I'm at the tail end of my second year. But, you know, I've been good.
What's second year like?
Second year is, it's demanding in that I really think that, you think about going from a med student to an intern year. You have more responsibilities, but nobody really expected a whole lot from you just because
you were an intern?
You started, you know? Yeah. And so, but now second year, you've been, you don't know everything, but you know enough to get things done, and but you're it's still a junior resident, so it's a lot of people asking you to get things done.
Do you feel like you've gotten like more confident, more efficient over the year, or you still feel like lost?
I feel like I've gotten more confident, more efficient. I know like at the beginning of the year I definitely still felt lost. I think getting some guidance, mentorship really helped, you know, with that. Cause you try to figure things out and you do some things that work and you do some things that don't, but it's good to have, somebody who knows more to bounce things off of.
Did you get a lot of like pager work your intern year, like on your ortho rotations? Did you have to hold the pager a bunch and like see consults and stuff? Like, did you feel prepared?
I didn't. Intern year or second year?
Intern year.
Intern year, no. I kind of felt like, you have somebody there. I mean, I'm holding the pager and whatnot, but you have somebody there. This is that, like, if there's something that actually needs to be done, like a reduction, something like that, and there's somebody there, you're not doing reductions by yourself, you know?
Yeah.
So, I think that helped with it. And then you start taking call, and you take call with, we take call like day one. And, being there and you do that throughout the year, throughout intern year, and then getting the second year is when you start, leading the show. Mm-hmm. And so, you've seen it done before, you've been a part of it. Now it's like, now it's you doing it, but it's definitely a different, being their assistant and being the one actually, hands-on.
Yeah. I didn't get much like my intern year. Like, we didn't hold the pager at all, basically. So when second year hit, it was, you just kind of go into it. Like, you dive in head first. I wasn't, that bad, but like, I don't know if this was you. There's always one person who's like a second year on call that July 4th weekend. That's like the first weekend of second year. And it's just like a fresh second year resident that's on call usually.
Yeah.
Dude, I don't know. That wasn't me. I don't think it was Jay either, but that wasn't you, was it?
No, I think
it wasn't me.
But, yeah, it wasn't either of us, but yeah, that's gotta be tough. I got lucky. I was like number 2 or 3 in line, so I got to ease into it a little bit, but at some point you just go in head first and figure it out, I guess. I don't know.
It sucks whoever draws the short end of the stick.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I don't remember who it was, but I know it wasn't me, though. So
how bad did you get yelled at, like, your first couple months?
Because
I got yelled at a bunch.
I get yelled at a lot. I got yelled at a lot. I think in my class, I probably got yelled at the most. I mean, it's not even hard to say. I know I got yelled at a lot. I got yelled at a ton, like a ton.
Dude, we all did. It's always for like little things, you know? It's always for like little things. And I don't know. I had a few like bigger mess ups, but it's always just like your splint's not on right, or you didn't get this x-ray or that x-ray and like stuff like that. I don't know. At least that's what it was for us. But
yeah.
Sometimes your upper levels get on you, but they're wrong and you're right. and then you just got to eat it. Is that right, Mo?
Yes, yeah.
If you have upper levels that, you know, are incorrect.
I mean, they're always wrong if you think that you're always right.
Must be why.
I mean, well, it's hard. Sometimes you hear conflicting things like, Dr. Jones, whoever, you know, says do it this way. And then you start doing it the way Dr. Jones wants it for Dr. Smith or whatever. And, you know, they're questioning you, looking at you kind of sideways. Like, why do you do it that way? That happened to me recently. So
it happens all the time, too. Yeah. If you're doing it with a bunch of people.
Yeah. So.
And no one agrees on the right way to do it. And usually when that happens, it's neither way is like the right way to do it. It's just personal preference, right? So it's like.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, you bring back a good point, because like I kind of forgot about that being out of residency for a while, but half of the game is figuring out who likes what and when to do that.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's not really orthopedics, you know, it's just like people pleasing.
Yeah, no, it really is. It's definitely people pleasing. It's like, you can't really win though. I mean, it just comes with the territory. I think that's just residency in general, because I'm sure if you, you know, ask, I don't know, internal medicine or some other, whatever other specialty, they, you know, can probably give examples of similar things.
Yeah. Orthopedics is kind of special with that though, because like there's so much stuff for you to do, right? Like splinting and x-rays and like we're not doing a bunch of lab work, but like, imaging, and then you know what position you want this and what position you want that, and
yeah, everything, you know, is hands-on. Like from the consults, like everything is hands-on. Yeah. And there's a bunch of, you know, all with all the imaging, the splinting, the different materials for splinting and all the stuff that we do, we do a lot, so there's a lot of room to mess up and, you know, to get called out on those mistakes, which happens very
soon. How comfortable do y'all feel? Like, obviously, when you're the junior resident, you have to set things up for the next day if it's an operative consult. And a lot of times you're uncertain of what, you know, of what to post for, like what table to use, what implants to use, this and that, because you're the junior resident and it's not your call anyway in the end, but you have to try to set it up. How comfortable do y'all feel just calling your attending to ask? And not you, Bo, you obviously you're not resident anymore, but you know, Mikey, like, is it something in your program where you feel like, oh yeah, we can call Dr. Smith, you know, he'll just let us know exactly what he needs? Or is it still something like, yeah, I don't really want to bother the attending, I don't want to waste the time, I'll just try to set it up?
I'd ask the chief before I ask the attending.
Good answer.
Yeah, you said what?
Good answer.
Yeah. I don't want to. I don't want to ask the attending that.
Yeah.
Because then, I mean, you know, if you know 99, then and that's the one thing you don't know. I mean, I just feel like it's. It just gives off a perception, and that you may don't know enough. They already don't think you know a ton, and you know, this is giving them kind of more ammo to further believe that, I guess.
Yeah, that's a, like, oh, go ahead, well, Jay.
As the attending now, like I make myself available to, you know, to for people to ask me questions. I feel like it'd be, now that I'm on the other side, it's kind of silly for me to expect things done a certain way if I never communicated that, you know, and I just expect things to be set up for me perfectly. It's like, you know, residency, you're worried about bothering the attending. But now that I'm the attending, it's like, dude, please ask me what I want. You know, I don't expect you all to like, to know exactly how I want things done. So I don't know. I just think it's interesting.
So I was going to say, from my side, it's like you can tell that you're at an academic center because you guys have these options to where you have choices. But like, dude, I have one bed or two, really. I've got like a regular table and then a fracture table, and that's all I have. So like, there's no, like, I don't have a choice of beds, you know. It's like either this one, or if I'm doing a hip fracture, it's a fracture table. But like, I guess most of my choice comes with implants, and I don't really have, I mean, I don't have residents or anything asking me either. So I brought that up just to say, like, in the real world, a lot of that stuff might not matter because you might not have all those cool tables that you have in residency, or like all those cool tools and drills and all that kind of stuff. Like, I don't even have a drill that can oscillate. Like picture that.
It oscillate?
It doesn't oscillate. I don't. It goes forward and reverse. I don't have an oscillating drill. So I'm trying to get one, but like, I don't even have a choice. You know what I mean? Like, I got the one drill, and that's what we go with.
You just got to flip from forward to reverse really fast.
What?
You just got to flip from forward to reverse really fast.
Just like this. You do that. Yeah. Like I'm doing your a controller. Cases,
do you get help for your cases?
I have a PA, yeah. Yeah, I have a PA.
Mm-hmm. And then, who pays the PA? Or is it hospital?
The hospital. Yeah, okay. Hospital. Because I'm employed. So if I was private, I'd pay him. Mm-hmm. It'd come out of my overhead, but no, that's the benefit of taking an employee job, is that the hospital will pay for that kind of stuff. So
yeah,
the hospital will pay for the PA, they'll pay for the overhead for the clinic and all that stuff. All I have to do is see patients at clinic, operate, and make sure that they're counting the RVUs right, so I get the bonus at the end.
What about rounding on your patients?
I usually work it out with him. I'm still in that phase where I still see all my post-ops. So I don't know, probably because I'm still fresh, but he'll see him like sometimes on the weekends. We'll work it out. Like I feel pretty comfortable with him. Like, hey, do you mind seeing this guy like this weekend? I'm not going to be here. Or do you mind seeing this guy tomorrow? And like he'll do orders and stuff like that too for me. So he kind of functions like a resident, except that he can't really do some of the stuff a resident can do, like autonomous decision making and that kind of stuff. But no, it works out, and it's nice because I don't have to pay him, and he's also He was there for 10 years before I got there. So he knows like the people in the hospital, and he knows like, you know, where to get what, and like the system and all that stuff. So it was really nice when I first started over there, because he kind of helped transition.
I mean, do residents have autonomous decision making?
Theoretically.
Huh. That's a social question. I don't know if that's because, I mean, I think theoretically, he's like, I mean, you essentially do what the attending is, you know, you carry out your attending's will, you know, essentially.
Yeah. Well, if you have your own medical license, theoretically, you could be on staff at the hospital, right?
Yeah.
As long as you don't have a training license.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I do feel like, you know, I can, I guess, do y'all still, still do reductions when you're on call and stuff?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You go to the emergency department?
Uh-huh.
For real?
Absolutely, man. Who else is going to do it?
I don't know.
So the way I figure it, so, you know, I'm in a community ER, so I get that kind of stuff coming, like just a radius, ankle, all that kind of stuff. The way I basically do it is I give the ER one chance, or I make the ER try it once. And just be like, hey, you guys try to reduce it, and if you can't get it, then I'll come in and do it. Mm-hmm. Same thing with like tapping knees and ankles and stuff. And a lot of it depends on who the ER attending is, because mm-hmm. some of them are a lot more comfortable. Like I'll get some that won't, that are scared to put a needle in a knee to aspirate a, you know, a rule out septic joint. And then I'll get some, like I got one, you know, one of these few weekends ago where they're like, hey, there's a prosthetic hip dislocation. Do you want to be here for it? And I'm like, how comfortable are you with it? He's like, no, I can put this in. Just, I don't know if you want to be here or not. And I'm like, no, go ahead. Never heard from him again. just it's perfect. So you get the full like gamut of comfort in the ER. And you know, I know when it's going to be a long night, I know when it's not. And I'm also lucky, and this is, you know, we were talking before about whether the attending life is better than residency life. One of the really good things about being an attending is that you can live with your own decision making. And probably the best part is that you don't have people checking over your shoulder every morning at conference, like, why'd you do this? Why'd you do that? Like, you know, you should have done it this way, you should have done it that way. If I get a distal radius come in and it's like, you know, 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night, and I have clinic the next morning, I don't need to go in to do anything. I just say, all right, have them follow up tomorrow morning in clinic with me, and I'll do it then, or I'll talk to them then. And I just do it that way, you know. Or it's like, hey, admit it to the hospital, so I'll see it in the morning. Like if a hip fracture comes in, right? Like if me going to see a hip fracture in the middle of the night, it's not going to change anything. It's not going to make the hip heal any faster, right? Yeah. I get them admitted to the hospitalist who's in-house. And then, you know, the next morning I stop by, do the work and get it done. And I don't think it affects patient care as much. So a lot of those little like rules and stuff that you learn in residency in the real world, they don't really apply because they don't make sense. You know what I mean?
Well, I don't understand why it comes to be that way in residency, you know, like what's the...
I think they're trying to teach you safe habits that are reproducible. And, you know, if you see a hip fracture at 9 o'clock at night versus if you see them at 9 o'clock in the morning, what changes, you know? Yeah. I've never seen anything change, really. Theoretically the ER could miss an open fracture, and I've had that happen before where they've missed an open fracture. You know, that stuff happens anyways, honestly. Like whether you're there or not, whether you're in house or not, that people will miss stuff, you'll miss stuff. I just don't know what it changes. And as long as you're practicing safe medicine and using your brain, I mean, I don't see what's wrong with it. So, yeah. And the biggest one, and you know, I was like this in residency, there's this whole thing like see every consult. You know, if they call you for anything, go see it. Like if they even want a curbside, you go see it. And the real world doesn't work that way. Because if you do that, you're going in every hour or two if you're in a busy ER. I don't function like that. Like, if I feel like I could safely triage something over the phone, then I do it. Yeah. And you know, the nice part is that if I mess up, I deal with it and I learn from it. There's no one to yell at me, no one to, you know, berate me over the phone or, you know, call me stupid resident or anything like that. You know, it's like I deal with it. So I don't know, Jay, you're the academician here. Like, what do you think?
No, I think you're right. Exactly. I love the nice thing about, I was telling Mikey over text earlier, one of the nice things about being an attending is you can really do things more on your own time. So, you know, my example is with him, I was like, if I want this Wednesday afternoon off and I'm not stuffed with cases or whatever, I don't have to schedule a case into that block. You know, I could take my kids to their gymnastics lessons, which is what I've been doing lately. And it's nice to have that freedom. But as to your question, you know, Mikey, like, you know, why isn't it that way in residency? I think there's a lot of factors. When you work in a level one academic hospital, the expectation is that it's a learning environment. So the ER, they don't really, they feel like they can have you guys, residents, do pretty much everything and they don't feel bad about it. So if something needs to be reduced, they don't feel like they need to give it a try. You know, if they're in an academic hospital, they're like, well, the ortho residents need to learn how to reduce things. So let's call orthopedics. So as a result, in these hospitals that y'all work at, you guys are called way more to actually come in and do things, I think, than in you know, the real world when you're working with the hospital and you're on call. You know, at least they'll try to get it done and let it be triaged over the phone. And then the other thing, if you're working on a level one center, you more often than not at a lot of level one centers, you are going to be busy enough to where you're probably going to be, you might as well just park yourself in house because there's going to be enough to do to keep it busy. So like the example Mo said with hip fractures, you know, if he has a hip fracture he's going to do tomorrow, Same for me at one of my hospitals at Clear Lake. You know, I don't necessarily have to tee up my own hip fracture if I can tee it up the next morning. But if you're in residency and the hip fracture comes in, you know, let's say, like, when are you going to tee it up? Are you going to wait for the next morning? Well, then what happens if you have five other consults overnight that you're busy with and you're behind? You know, then you're going to wish you teed up that hip fracture when it came in. So I think part of it is just, if you're at a level one hospital, you're going to be busy enough to where you should be doing things as they're coming into the hospital. And the other part of it is, in an academic institution, the ER expects you to take care of a lot of that, to quote unquote, you know, learn how to do it. So those are probably the reasons. Those are probably some of the big reasons why in residency, you don't really have that luxury as a resident to do stuff on your own time.
The other thing you don't really learn at a level one is like triaging orthopedic consults to the ones that you know or you think that you can't handle and having to send them to a different hospital. Because you probably never had to do that at a level one, because you are the hospital. Yeah, you are the referral center, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So like, for example, one of these past weekends, I had a pilon come in, shattered pilon, right? And me as half sports, half general, I can't remember the last pilon I've done. Like, in my hands, this is a tough one. And, they call me, basically, they're like, look, he didn't have pulses at first, the ER did. And I reduced it and I got the pulses back. Meaning she just like pulled on the leg and got the pulses back. And what do you want to do? So, you know, I'm like, well, I guess I could X fix this. I can do it here, but eventually I'm going to have to ship it out anyways. Right. So I had to call one of the local trauma guys who's at a level one, or who's at the, you know, academic center nearby, and ask him what he wanted me to do. And, you know, I offered like, look, I don't mind X fixing this and having him follow up with you. But he's like, no, just, let's do an ER-to-ER transfer and I'll take care of it next week. Cause you know, they have residents, they have the resources. Me, I don't even have vascular in house. So like, if something goes wrong, I'm stuck. You know what I mean? So it's things like that. You gotta learn what resources you have, what resources you don't. And that's also part of like practicing safe orthopedics in a community setting, is being able to triage what you can and can't do there. And like, there's some things that will come in that I can't do. Like pathologic fractures just really bad bony metastases everywhere. Like I'm not set up to deal with that kind of stuff. I've got like a 3-bed ICU. I don't have an oncologist in house. I don't have radiation in house. I barely have a blood bank in house. So it's like, if I hit, you know, a met that's just going to bleed out, this guy's getting lifelighted to the next hospital over. It's part of that also that I think, I don't know, residency could probably do a better job of trying to treat that, especially if you have community hospitals.
Yeah. That's actually, I never even like considered that. That's a very important skill to like learn and develop.
Yeah. I didn't have that either in residency, you know, like even our community hospital in residency, like Victory Lakes, we were making this push to do everything there. And a lot of that was a political push because they wanted to increase the volume there to justify the hospital. But like, I remember there was one weekend I was on call where we got a pretty bad supracondylar come in.
And a kid.
And like, we weren't set up to do a supracondylar there. We don't have peds. We don't have, anything around there. So I was like, well, let's ship it down. And it got taken out of my hands, thankfully, but, sometimes there's just politics that play into it and you kind of lose that skill of what you can and can't do. I think, you know, as a two, that's not really what you're focusing on, but once you get to your chief year, if you can get into a community hospital and kind of run a service on your own, that's a big, big skill for just going into general practice. Cause I don't know what the percentage is, but I think most orthopedists don't go into academics, right out of fellowship or residency. I think a lot of people go into the community and go into general practice. And that's the kind of decisions you have to make.
Yeah.
What is the percentage, I wonder?
I don't know. I really don't. There's not that many academic jobs, so it can't be that much, right?
Yeah.
I mean, unless you're doing trauma. I mean, I bet even a lot of trauma guys will go into the community as a general traumatologist.
One of our friends, mutual friends, took a job and absolutely no call involved in his job. So all the stuff about call and stuff, you may, Mike, you may just take a job, but you don't even have to take call anymore.
Yeah. So when I was negotiating my contract here, they offered the same thing. They're like, look, you don't have to take call if you don't want to. Like we can, we were thinking about basically contracting with some other orthopedic surgeons in the area to take the call here all the time. So if you don't want to take call, like that's fine. But you know, I'm young trying to grow a practice. I mean, no, I'll take the call. I kind of like doing the call. So yeah, some people just don't take call, especially if you do an elective, elective fellowship. Like I'd say that's pretty small percentage though. Right, Jay? Like I feel like, especially right out of practice, most people are taking call to drum up business. Like one of my co-fellows is taking call at 5 different hospitals in Florida because he can't get cases. He's like a pure private guy, but he's in a really competitive market in Florida. So he's trying to get whatever business he can. And it's one of those things where you can't get on a call schedule enough. So he has to take call at 5 different hospitals just to get enough call for his month so that he can try to get some cases. So you get that at end of it too.
It's a especially struggle. Competitive.
Yeah. Well, I guess that, what city are you in, Mo?
I'm outside of Syracuse. It's probably the easiest way to put it.
So it's because I guess that kind of goes with like, you know, having that. I imagine like a real competitive market must be like in a really like, you know,
bigger cities.
City. Yeah, yep. Bigger cities. Yep. So
bigger cities. Trying to go private in bigger cities is tough. It's really tough nowadays.
And I, go ahead.
If you're okay living in a small town, that opens up your options so much, and also the amount of money you make. Yeah.
Unless you're going academics, if you are the only one of the, I think the move if you want to go to a big town is find an employed job or find an academic job, which is basically an employed job at this point. It's really tough to go straight private in a big city or in a populous city. So you want that hospital backing so that they can feed you cases, feed you patients. You have a referral base already built in. So you don't have to go, you know, hand out your business cards at primary care offices or hand out your business cards at emergency rooms. And
especially
early in your career, especially like straight out of in your career, that kind of stuff is tough, man. It you're already struggling as it is to try to figure out how to be an attending and how to do your own cases and what you like to do for your cases. All that extra stress of trying to get enough business it can be tough.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think a lot of people are doing still private, but if you're going to do private, you need to either join a group that's already established that can help you or, you know, go into a less populous area to where you'll be able to get the business to support yourself.
Yeah. And what I imagine, like, you know, what I hear a lot of people do is like, they'll finish training and, you know, go, I mean, a lot of people like, you know, kind of go where they grew up at or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just imagine it to be, I guess not that easy, just like you said, but I don't know, like maybe working outside the city or something like that. If that's your, like, really, if that's your goal. Cause I think that's a lot of people's goal.
That's what a lot of people do. Like, especially where I am. Like I work 30 minutes from where I live. Mm-hmm. So I live closer to Syracuse, but I work, you know, 30 minutes out. So it's a little more rural, a little more community. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I did 60 something cases last month, which is a lot for where I'm at. Just because it's not as competitive. It's just not. So I get the cases and I have a whole hospital system backing me. So I have the whole hospital referral base, all the PCPs from the hospital, you know, all the other staff at the hospital, they can all refer into my clinic and I can get the cases that way too. So if you don't have that, you're struggling to drum up business and advertise yourself and get your name out there for people to make appointments to see you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of people who have 2-3 patients in a whole day of clinic just because that's all they can get.
Man.
Yeah. Imagine that. Imagine doing 2-3 cases a month as a private guy. It doesn't pay the bills.
Then your private practice gets bought out.
Yeah. And then you're employed.
Then you're employed. Yep.
So I don't know. Private practice, it's tough because, you know, your ceiling is a lot higher than if you're employed, right? That's the benefit of private practice, is you have that ceiling that you can, theoretically, you can make as much money as you want. You just have to work for it. But you have to be able to do that work, right? If you don't have the patience to do the work, then you're screwed. You're screwed. You're stuck paying the bills without any money to pay them. And then your practice goes under and you get bought out, like Jay said. If you were going to go private, just make sure, do your homework on the group that you're with and see what kind of market share they have, and make sure there's a need. That's the big thing, right? I think one of our guests had mentioned this when we were talking about finding a job. He's like, he said, one of the biggest things is make sure that there's a need wherever you're going, and there's a need that you can fill, because that's how you're going to make your business. If you go somewhere where, if you're a sports guy, like if I'm a sports guy fresh out of practice and I want to do private practice and I go to Houston in the city, dude, I'm done within 6 months. Like, I'm not going to get any cases over there. There's so many sports guys over there, right? But here, there's not many people doing sports. So I show up, I kind of clean up over here because there's not many people doing it. Like, there's not many upper extremity guys where I'm at. So I can get a lot of those cases. I get a lot of the cuffs and the reverses and the anatomics up here. Yeah. So just, you know, you got to do your homework. You got to make sure that there's a need for you. And if you're joining a group, make sure that they actually need what you're giving them. Make sure you're actually going to fill a role and not just going to be an add-on, or not going to be like just another person in the pile. And like a lot of places will kind of advertise when you're interviewing, like, hey, we had a guy who's going to retire here in a couple years, or he's going to retire soon. Make sure that's actually the case, because, you know, if he doesn't retire and they were kind of planning on you to take over his role, then you're stuck again. And that's like 3-4 years of your career that you've kind of just wasted. So all these little things, man, nobody really teaches you until you make the mistake and you see other people make those mistakes. So things to watch out for on the job hunt.
Yeah. So much of it is luck and uncertainty, and you either end up in a good situation or you don't. And it's hard to foresee that ahead of time. Like Mo, like you, here, your position was, you know, you were looking at an academic job. Obviously COVID hit and then things changed, and, you know, you signed this job. Do you have an idea of what you're getting into when you started? Or, I mean, obviously now you're looking good, but it turned out well for you. But it wasn't like, you know, you got the job offer and you're like, this is like going to go great. It was more like, you know, let's go see how this goes, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was the benefit of being able to do locums for a little bit, right? Like with locums, you kind of got to get to try it before you buy it. Make sure that you actually need it there. Make sure that it's what you like and you like the area that you live in and all that kind of stuff. I don't know. It worked out well for me. I got lucky, I think. I kind of walked into a good opportunity. But then, you know, again, it was a bit of luck, but it was also a bit of me being flexible. Like, I didn't have anything tying me down, so I could fly halfway across the country to a job, to an area I've never been and have no connections to try it. It's just my options were a lot more than someone who, you know, has family in a certain town that they have to go back to. Like, you know, then you're stuck, you're geographically limited, and then your job options are a lot lower. So you're more likely to find a job that's not going to be the right fit for you, or, you know, you box yourself into a certain type of job. Like, I was like dead set on doing academics for the longest time, right? Like dead set on it. I was only looking at academic jobs. And then, you know, once those jobs started dwindling because of COVID, it's like, I had to expand out. And, you know, now looking back, I'm like, why did I want to do academics?
Why did you want to do academics?
Well, I wanted to teach. I really wanted to teach. That was my big thing. But, you know, it's probably easiest to teach in an academic job, but there's other, like we have med students come through the hospital. We don't have residents right now, but there's a residency program nearby that sends the residents out to different community hospitals. I don't see why I can't set that up in the future. Like, if you still want to do that stuff, you can do it outside of an academic job. But it's not as, you know, structured, and it's not as easy. It's definitely not as easy. But that was my big thing. And, you know, I don't know. It would have been nice, I think. And academics is I think it's good to start out with, especially in your career, because you got a lot of support behind you. you have a lot of people, you know, if you're in a good department, you have a lot of people around you who have kind of been through what you've been through, who can help you out with cases, help you out with your decision-making, help you out with, like, you know, stuff you don't really learn, like how to set up your clinic properly, how to set up your OR and your block times and how to schedule your cases, like all these things that you don't really learn as a resident. There's a big cushion, you know, when you're in academics, especially as a young surgeon. Plus you have residents to help you out too. You have an extra set of hands all the time. And on top of that, you're not really worrying about your, you know, your finances as much. You don't have to worry about how much you're spending on overhead or how many cases you're bringing in every month, how much, you know, how many clinic patients you're seeing every month. Like all that stuff, like, yeah, it's important eventually, if especially if, as we incentive, we, a lot of these contracts move to incentive bonuses, but you have that safe salary that's just, you know, propping you up, that you don't have to worry, like, I need to do 30 cases every month, otherwise I'm in the red for my budget, you know, and early on in your career, that stuff's invaluable. So yeah, I am lucky to end up where I ended up with the job I have. But academics starting out, it's awesome. I think, I don't know, you can, Jay, you're there. You agree?
Yeah, it's good. There's a lot of benefits to it. Yeah, at the same time, there's some nice things about private as well. So it's hard. There's not really a perfect job for a lot of people, I guess. So, you know, what I like about academics is I like the environment of being around residents, and it's a teaching environment. It's fun. I get to talk to people and they have no choice but to listen to what I say, you know, which is nice. And it's just it's a very collegial, like, supportive, happy environment. And I, you know, if I have really tough cases, you know, I can always pass it to one of my partners if it's their area of specialty. You know, some complex comes in on call, like a complex discoradius fracture or something, but, you know, I have a hand partner to pass it to. But the nice thing about, you know, not being an academic is, in a way, as a young surgeon, I feel like I was talking to you about this, Mo, like, you can really expand your skills faster in a way, because you don't have the pressure of letting a resident do the case. And you can really develop your efficiency at a faster rate, I think, which is why in residency, when we got new attendings who had been in private practice for 10 to 15 years, it was remarkable seeing them, how efficient they were and how skilled they were. So I think there's benefits to both, you know?
Yeah, that's we were talking about that earlier. It's like, what do you want to do with your career, right? And that answer might change throughout your career, but you need to talk about what do you want to do with your career at that moment? So if you want to super specialize in, you know, only doing total ankles, you're not going to be able to do that as a generalist in the community, right?
Right.
It's just not going to happen. You're not going to be able to survive just doing total ankles. But, you know, if you want to be a generalist and help out as many people as you can and, you know, just learn to be a good surgeon, I don't know. It really depends on what your goals are. Because academics will allow you to do certain things that I'm not going to be able to do where I'm at. You know, I'm not going to be a guy who's going to do 400 total shoulders every year over here. It's just, I don't have the volume to support it, right? I'm not going to be doing 600 ACLs a year like Walt Lowe does, but I can still fill a niche, right? I get to do everything. I get to do the cuff. I get to do the ACL. I get to do the ankle fractures. I get to do the hip fractures. I think there's a benefit in that. I mean, I'm biased, but I think there's benefit in that because it keeps your skills up. And if I ever wanted to go back to academia later on in my career, I could, and I'd still have the skills to do it. But I think it's a lot tougher. Jay, tell me if you agree. It's a lot tougher to go from 20 years in academics into the community than it is to go from 20 years into the community into academics later on, as far as operating.
I think it's tougher to go from academics into the community, for sure. Just because in the community, you've got a lot less help and you've been spoiled. You know, I've got a resident every case. Sometimes I have two residents sometimes. And I've got a medical student sometimes. So there's always hands to help. And then when you're in the community, sometimes you don't have that. One of my co-fellows he's affiliated with Rush. But you know, he's kind of out on his own in on an island, more or less. And you know, when he does complex fracture work or complex cases, he doesn't have that extra set of hands to to put some hardware in while he's holding reduction. You know, he's got to figure out ways to do that himself. And, you know, once you get spoiled in academics for so long, it is very hard, I think, to go back the other way. Whereas if you're in the community, you know, you have to adjust to academics as well. We have to adjust to the teaching environment, and no longer can you do your own cases start to finish without residents complaining. You don't have as much control over your staff and other aspects of your practice. But in terms of the peer, you know, you've already developed the ability to operate by yourself and be efficient at doing it.
And be autonomous. I think that's a big thing, yeah, being autonomous. Exactly. Like being able to fend for yourself and do your own clinic notes, do your own orders, yep, do that kind of stuff.
It's easier to make that adjustment. You're basically adjusting to having more help in a way, which is much easier to adjusting to having less help.
Now, I'll tell you what would be tough. Like if I was to jump into, like if we were going to switch places tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
The toughest part for me would be not being able to control my own schedule, not being able to control who's around me, like the staff that I have around me. Losing a bit of that control would be tough because you're so used to having it set up. You're used to having it set up in a system that's designed to make you faster, you specifically. Yeah. Right. Like everyone needs a different setup to be maximally efficient for them. Like my setup is going to be different than Jay's setup because we're just two different people who operate two different ways. Right. But once you get to that academic center or that, you know, big hospital group, same thing, they're not designed to make you efficient. I mean, they're designed to be the most efficient for everyone, or theoretically, that's what they should be doing. Right. So me being the only surgeon in my group, I have it set up the way I like it. Like, you know, I have the patient going to x-ray this way and then coming back to the waiting room and doing that, like based on my speed and based on how long I take in patient rooms. And, you know, I have knees set up differently than shoulders. I got the equipment that I want for the cases that I want. I don't have to use someone else's equipment. Well, I do kind of, cause I don't have a drill that oscillates. I mentioned that earlier, but, you know, it's a work in progress. We're getting there. Yeah, that would be really tough for me is going into an academic center. And I think that's a little understated because, yeah, you have more help, but they don't know the way you like to do stuff. And that could be a big, big blow, especially to efficiency.
One hard thing, if you're, you know, if I've always been, yeah, as a chief resident, I've always let my juniors do a lot. And as an attending, I always try to let my chief residents now do a lot as well. And one of the things that is like, you know, the thing that I feel like I've missed the most about not being in the community is, we'll give you an example. The other day we're doing this IT fracture nail, and it's something, you know, I have really good residents. They can handle the case start to finish. I don't need to scrub for these cases. And I kind of stand on the side and I look and, you know, I make one or two mild adjustments, you know, suggestions to the residents, like, yeah, I think we should sink the nail a little further, you know, maybe that interlock is, we need to get a better x-ray on that interlock to make sure it's actually through the nail. Like, these are important things. I'm contributing to the case, and I'm, you know, the case goes well, the final x-rays look great, I know I played my part. But if, you know, if I'm not the one scrubbed in, putting that implant in, you know, I was telling Mo, sometimes it feels like, I don't really know, it's my case, but I don't, sometimes you have to struggle with, is it really my case? Did I really do it? You know, like, obviously I helped and I supervised and I got it done, you know, whatever. But if you're not the one with your own hands putting it in, I don't know if it's quite as satisfying, you know. That's one thing. If obviously the thing I miss most about, I've never been in a community, but at least, you know, as a resident, if you're the one putting it in with your hands, then, you know, there is a satisfaction feeling that you get. You know, so when my residents, I talked about this before, one of our loyal listeners, a resident of mine, you know, he wasn't really feeling it for a week or so. I know he's going to listen to this episode and for other reasons. And I got to, you know, I really didn't have a resident for a few cases. And, you know, when I did have a resident, he thankfully was like, yeah, Jay, you know, you can do these cases. So for that week, like, and I was operating for a few days, literally the one doing it, I was like, man, this is like really fun still. When you're doing it, you're like, wow, you know, trimal and like under 60 minutes, like, dang, that was awesome. And but then you go back to teaching and letting people do it. So, you know, I think that's the thing I miss most about, or I would miss most about being in the community.
There's something There's something to doing the parts of the case and having things not go as ideal as you want, and then seeing the follow-up and figuring out whether that actually makes a difference or not. You don't get that as a resident or a fellow, because there's always someone looking over your back. And a lot of times you don't have the follow-up to identify that. So Jay, this is probably going to be something different between you and me, because, you know, a lot of the little parts of the case that you have a resident do, I'm still doing. And, you know, if I mess it up, like if I put a screw in a funky location and, you know, I realize, oh, shoot, I messed up, and then I have to correct it. All those little things, like, I don't know, unless you just went to a really, really hands-on residency, I don't think you get, I really don't, until you're out in practice and you have to do every little piece by yourself. And then having the follow-up is huge, right? Like, if there was a way to add that into residency, I think that would be one of the most educational things that they can do, is just seeing the long-term follow-up of the cases that you do. Because you see them for the first six weeks or so, maybe 3 months, but you don't get the long-term follow-up. You don't get 6 month, year, 2 years. And I was telling Jay this, I'm just now starting to get a lot of my 6 month follow-ups come back, and I'm seeing what worked, what didn't work. Starting to think, like, what do I want to change? What do I want to add? What do I want to do next time I do this? And you modify your practice. Like, your practice evolves as you get your follow-ups. And it's kind of funny, because I think there are some people that would argue, like, you should be doing that anyways based on the literature, because you're changing your practice based off sample sizes that aren't powered enough to make a statistically significant assumption. But my argument would be that the way you operate is not necessarily the way that everyone else operates in the studies, in the literature. So, it's a heterogeneous population. So the way I do things might not reflect in the literature. So changing my practice based off studies, I do it, but I go mostly off of the mistakes I make on my own. So like if I'm doing, let's say like if I'm doing rotator cuffs one way, right, with one anchor configuration, and I have a few of them come back that just aren't as good as, you know, some of the other ways I've been doing it, I change it, right? There might not be literature to back it up, but in my hands, one way works better than the other. Just like, you know, for the way I do ACLs, one graft in my hands is not the same as that graft in someone else's hands. So that's a big thing that we kind of, I don't think we overlook it really in residency and training, but I don't know if we paid enough attention that we should. And that's developing your own individual way of operating and what's good with what you do and how you do things versus what's good with other people.
Yeah, no, you're right about that.
Residency, because I mean, a lot of the stuff, I mean, the residents aren't making the final decision necessarily.
Right. Yeah. And you can't really do it. You can't learn that side of it because you don't have the volume to do it. And if you're doing a case start to finish without the attending scrubs, how many of those do you really get in residency? Mm-hmm. Like you might get a lot in a little bit, but each individual case that you do, it's not enough to judge what you do well and what you don't do well. Often, you know, sample size is probably maybe a handful or 10, not enough. I don't know.
Yeah, the best, I mean, orthopedic studies, even the best level one studies that are done at, you know, well-known institutions by well-known people, they are really only generalizable to those surgeons. They're not universally generalizable, just like you're saying. And it's different than, you know, an internal medicine study where you're testing a new drug and you have 100,000 participants and they're blinded, double-blinded, randomized, prospectively collected. You know, the best level one orthopedic study is not anywhere near as good as a level one internal medicine study in terms of being generalizable to anyone or to everyone, because it's always, surgeons are always different. I'll read a study and let's say there's a study that says, you know, sinus tarsi approaches to calcs, you know, do better than open, extensile open for these, you know, in terms of these outcomes. And then I may read that study and say, okay, I guess I should do more sinus tarsi calcs. But what if in my hands, I just really freaking suck at sinus tarsi calcs, you know?
Yeah. As some people, example, like, yeah, that. there's some stuff that you're going to find that you're just not good at.
Yeah.
That you're just not good at this approach, or you're just not good at this plate, this specific plate by this company. doesn't work well with you. Like the holes, it's something weird. Like you can't explain it, but it just doesn't work well for you, right? And that's the kind of stuff that you pick up. I mean, look, I'm only 6 months in, but I'm already starting to see that kind of stuff. Like, I just don't, this way just doesn't work well for me. This way just doesn't work well for me. And I don't know. It's when I first started, I tried to do a lot of the stuff the way I was trained to do it, like in fellowship and in residency. And over the last few months, I've already started to modify a lot of it to the way I like to do things myself. And you kind of develop your own style of doing things. And that's the fun part. Going back, I think that's where I might have an easier time doing that than Jay does, because I'm having to deal with all those parts. I don't have a resident there to do things for some of that. I see it as a benefit, but there's also cons to it. So
for sure. I think if your goal, if you're thinking about jobs, you're thinking about academic versus community, if your goal is to absolutely develop into the best, most efficient surgeon you can be, if that's the most important thing and the most broadly skilled or whatever, I think community will probably give you a leg up on that. Just the number of reps you get, being hands-on, you're by yourself all the time.
Yeah.
If your goal is to, teach residents and to explore new ways of doing things, maybe get published, and I think and be in a type of educational community, which is good on its own. Obviously academics gives you that, but
and research is the big thing that you can't do anywhere else really efficiently outside of a big academic spot. So if that's really important to you, to some of us that sounds silly, but there's a few people out there that their big thing is research. They don't mind being, not that high volume of a surgeon, as long as they can do the research and get their name in the literature, and God bless them, because we need more people like that. But that's not me.
I guess, like looking at your own outcome, wouldn't it matter? I guess even with the sinus tarsi example that you gave, I think some of it is definitely, a lot of it is generalizable. Like, sinus tarsi approach does better than the open approach. And if the reason is because of wound issues, then I guess that wouldn't really matter whose hands it is. It's just the nature of the intervention being done.
So I think that's part of being able to critically read a study.
Yeah.
And whether or not that's going to change your practice, right? Because that's the ultimate thing, is the study you read going to change what you do? What if you're the best in the world at doing an extensile lateral, and you have a way of closing your wound, and you have a way of prepping the skin and managing that to where you've done 100 patients extensile lateral and never had a wound issue? Like, there's some people that would argue that. They're like, the way I do things, I don't have that problem. Like, I'll use sports for an example, right? There's some people who will say that in my BTBs, the way I close the peritoneum over the patella, the way I graft the patella and the tibia, I don't get any symptomatic anterior knee pain the way I do it. The counter argument to that is, okay, then you should publish that, right? That's the counter argument is, if you're doing that well, then put it on paper and let someone peer review what you're doing. But a lot of those guys don't want to do it. They just don't want to put the effort in to publish their results, because they're not trying to change practice. They're not trying to change other people's practice. It works for them and what they want to do. But I agree with you. There's definitely some literature out there that will change the stuff, the way I see things and the way I do things.
For sure.
It's pretty clear. Like there's a benefit to doing this.
Yeah. For sure. If it makes logical sense, like sinus tarsi, less wound complications, it makes logical sense, plays out in the literature. That's something that probably can be generalized. But so say in that same study, they say, these surgeons were able to have less wound complications while having the same quality of reduction as open. Then you read that study and you think, okay, I believe the part about wound complications, but in my hands, am I skilled enough to actually have the same quality of reduction as if I were to open it up? And that's the part that you have to assess for yourself, that you can't just blindly accept that conclusion and apply it to every surgeon.
Using that example, if the guy who's fixing your calcaneus has done 500 extensile lateral approaches and like 5 sinus tarsi, despite what the literature says, what would you want him to do? You'd want him to do the one that he knows that, you know, that can produce a reliable result in his hands, or you go find another surgeon that will do it the way you want it, right? Which is what a lot of patients do. But you just, I don't know, you got to judge in your hands, what can you provide a reliable, safe result with that will maximize the patient's outcomes? That answer is different for different surgeons. And yeah, like in residency, I remember, you know, we criticized the way a lot of attendings did stuff that seemed older or seemed out of date. That's my view on that has changed a lot in the last 6 months, just because you see it. Like, you know, in probably 3-4 years down the line, if I have a resident come through to rotate with me, he'll probably say, why are you doing it this way? Why aren't you using this device? Why aren't you using this? It's because I don't need to. Like, I get good results with the stuff I have because I'm used to it and I know it works and I know how to use it. That's where it is. So I don't know. I was one of those guys that was a little critical. Like, why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? Why are you doing this technique? Why aren't you using this technique? But you know, that's changed for me.
Yeah, sure. All right. Mike, go ahead. Y'all have any more thoughts?
I would say there was one, what's that saying, that you don't want to be the first to do something, you don't want to be the last to do something. We'll leave with that.
Yeah. All right. Mikey, one last thing I want to get your thoughts on before you bounce, if you have time. Basically, you know, this, you know, a lot of medical students, match was a few weeks ago, obviously, and a lot of medical students couldn't match were left scrambling. Just what are your thoughts? I know you went through that yourself. What are your thoughts on that whole process? And what, do you have any advice to give any medical students who are going through that?
Well, I think my thoughts on it are, I guess this year was a little different because, like, traditionally people would be able to do away rotations and go on interviews in person, but now you couldn't even do the interviews. Everything was, you know, in front of a computer screen. I think that, I think you gotta, you know, kind of understand what each thing in the application is kind of used for and how much weight it has, generally speaking. And then on an interview trail, you know, lean to your strengths, for example. I think that your board scores are super important, but in my head, at least, the biggest thing that they're there for is to get whatever program you're applying to start to have a conversation with you, to invite you for an interview. That's the purpose it serves. And once you're there, I think it really helps to prepare for the interview and by, like, you know, doing your homework on the program and if you can get and whoever it is that's going to interview you and strengthening your soft skills. I think the difference between whenever I didn't match and whenever I did match was, you know, my soft skills. You know, I got a lot better interviewing. I kind of knew what I wanted to get out of each interview. Strengthening your soft skills, what I mean by that is, like, you know, I think an interview is a conversation. It's a back and forth conversation. And so, call your mom, call your aunt, just talk to people a lot. Talk to the Uber on your way there. You know, I think it's a muscle that gets worked
out. Start a podcast.
On a podcast.
Start a podcast.
Yeah. I know match week just wasn't that long ago. And for people that didn't match, I think, the first thing you should do is, what are you going to do next? Well, first thing you should do, why didn't you match? What do you think it was? Everybody's going to ask you why you didn't match. Was it your scores or was it your interviews or was it, you know, what happened? And then what are you going to do next? Are you going to do research or are you going to do a prelim year or, you know, what's the next step? Or are you going to, try to, you know, get into a different specialty. There's different things you can do But I think ultimately it kind of goes into what, I mean, are you, like, I mean, what do you, are you willing to accept the consequences if things don't go the way you want to, want them to go, you know, with whatever your next step is? So, you know, if you, you know, go into a prelim year to reapply and you could very well not match again. That's a possibility, but you got to, I mean, you can kind of play the games with that. Or, well, shoot, I mean, didn't match orthopedics, but, you know, you just want to move forward with your life and go in, you can go into a different specialty. That's an option as well, you know, but whatever it is, you just got to have to be okay with swallowing that pill. And with whatever you, whichever you do, move forward with it. And whether you, you know, reapply or, you know, do research or whatever it is, you know, I think it helps to get started on it sooner rather than later, because I don't know, it just gives you a lot more, like it gives you a more comfortable cushion to get things, what, you know, logistical things, whatever things you're trying to get done, you know, done. And it's, I mean, it sucks not matching, but and you don't have a whole lot of time to make really big decisions. I mean, you don't match on, you find out you didn't match on Monday, and you know, you got to make some big decisions that same week. And so, I mean, you fell down, but pick yourself up because you got to get moving.
Good advice.
Yeah.
Cool, man. All right, Mikey. Well, thanks for coming on, bro.
You know, thanks, Mikey.
All right, man. Later. Have a good one. You too. And that'll do it for this week. Hope you guys enjoyed that episode. They don't call us the realest orthopedic podcast on the planet for nothing. So hope you guys enjoyed it. If you guys do enjoy the podcast and want to catch any of our other episodes, you can do so at our website.com. If you want to see the accompanying video for this episode, you can do so at our YouTube channel, The Ortho Podcast, Ortho Talk Podcast on YouTube. If you want to get in touch with us, do so at our Twitter, at OrthoTalkPod, or at our Gmail, theorthopodcast@gmail.com. That'll do it for this week. Hope you guys enjoy it, and we will see you next week. Thank you for the opportunity.